This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Welcome to part two of Mimi's interview with Harriet Washington.
Harriet Washington has been a fellow in ethics at the Harvard Medical School and a senior research scholar at the National Center for Bioethics at Tuskegee University. And as a journalist and editor, she has worked for publications such as the New England Journal of Medicine. But her contribution to educating, agitating, and organizing was most cogently served by her blockbuster book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. And now she's done it again with her explosive book, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. We're joined by Harriet Washington to talk about this powerful and indispensable book on the devastating consequences of environmental racism and what we can do to remedy its toxic effects on marginalized communities. And the issue of exposure and testing. Are we doing what we need to? For example, you raise issues around PCBs and the like. Talk about that and also what needs to be done to rectify the problem with how we register what level of exposure actually is destructive.
PCBs are a great example because in 1982, the people, mostly African American of Afton, North Carolina, were protesting the dumping of PCBs in their neighborhood. And it was like a civil rights spectacle. They were being arrested and taken to jail. The sheriff was invoking law and order, but these people were actually the victims of a crime because the EPA had permitted the illegal dumping of these PCBs so that the other quote-unquote whites of North Carolina would not be affected by them. So another good example of the EPA's desultory response to poisoning. But another really important factor in limiting our exposure is the fact that in this country we have 200 known industrial chemicals that affect cognition, not just poison the bodies but also poison the mind. Most of the chemicals, 60,000 industrial chemicals are in use that have either never been tested for their effects on human health or have been tested in a very poor manner, according to Philippe Grandjean, who wrote an excellent book called Only One Chance, where he documents and lists all these 200 chemicals that he calls brain drainers. So we're not testing these chemicals, and we're not testing them adequately. But in the European Union, what we do is we wait until someone has been harmed or their claims of harm. Then we'll begin testing them. And then often industry protests the tests do not, quote-unquote, prove that this causes the injury. And there's this downward spiral where we end up investing many years and many decades until finally it's determined, yes, this is actually a serious problem. And at that point, the cost has been enormous, not only in dollars, but in lost brain and lost IQ. So in the European Union, they do things differently. You can't use a chemical that's going to come into contact with human beings without testing it first. That's what we should do. We should test chemicals first, but we don't.
Harriet Washington, one of the things that you pointed out is, I believe, nearly two out of every five African-American homes in Baltimore are plagued by lead-based paint. Almost all of the 37,000 Baltimore children who suffered lead poisoning between 2003 to 2015 were African Americans. So continue to educate us on exactly how our public health is infected by the atmospheric pollution, the infectious disease, the industrial waste, because I don't think that collectively we still are tuned in, which you help us do enormously, to how detrimental to the intellectual development and, again, the really sanctity and having a healthy life are.
Well, there are so many different routes of exposure and so many deleterious chemicals. There's no way I can discuss them all in a telephone interview, but I can say that if you look at the atmospheric pollution, which some would argue is the chief source of pollution, there is like a wide variety of exposures. And some of the things that we don't think of as being especially harmful are very harmful. For example, particulate matter, basically what we lay people call soot, right? Black carbon. This is very dangerous to the lungs. We've always known that. It triggers cancer. It triggers various lung diseases, depending on what's in these particulate matter. Okay, but then it also, a lot also has magnetite, which is, of course, as the name implies, a magnetic form of iron, and it travels directly to the brain. You breathe in the soot. The magnetite in the soup, actually, and the soot actually hitches a ride on your olfactory nerve directly into the brain. Now, you don't have to be a doctor to know that having magnetic iron loading up your brain is not a good thing. It's not a healthy thing. So it's very dangerous. It happens a great deal. And we know that people who live in areas or have been exposed for a long time to air pollution, living near fence line communities, for example, we know that as they age, their cognition gets worse than their peers. And this is one of the many, many reasons why. But we're not only talking about heavy metals. But there's also the fact that in many areas where people of color live, they're living in housing. Baltimore is a good example, but so is New York. They're living in housing, which is older tenement buildings, older and crumbling, not well maintained, and also it's infected with vermin, roaches, dust mites, you name it. Roaches and roach parts have been linked directly to rates of asthma since at least the 1970s. And asthma directly lowers your cognition. If you have asthma, especially asthma, which is not really well managed over decades, you keep having these episodes. Not everybody, of course. People with like the worst case of asthma or people who are vulnerable for other reasons. You repeatedly have spells in which you can't breathe, your brain does not get enough oxygen, and when that happens over time repeatedly, it's parts of your brain die off, and you end up with lowered cognition directly due to the asthma. So this means that people who are living in housing that is old and crumbling and has these problems are more likely to end up with lower cognition. Also, some of the vermin, for example, in 1990s, the CDC researchers found that sole, a virus carried by rodents in crumbling urban housing, could increase hypertension. Hypertension over time will also lower cognition. So we have this horrible, very complex interplay of health risks that are tied to people being forced into certain areas to live as a result of segregation. And I have to make an aside here because I used to think, like a lot of people used to think, that segregation was over. I mean, certainly de jure segregation ended in the 1960s. And we know that the fact of segregation persisted. But I did not know until I spoke with David Williams at the Harvard School of Public Health that segregation has actually increased. Segregation is still a very serious problem in our country. And it's so bad that if we wanted to restore parity, there were no segregationist country, two-thirds of African Americans would have to move from where they are to another area. So we would no longer have racially disparate housing. So, of course, when you have racially disparate areas, it's easy for people to be exposed to hazards that other people are not exposed to. And that, you know, in a thumbnail is what's going on across the country. Nancy Krieger has shown that in Jim Crow areas where there were, like, strict segregation and curtailment of health treatment based on race in the South, she's shown that the descendants of these people still have poorer health, including poorer mental health. So segregation is like a big part of what's going on, yesterday's segregation as well as today's segregation.
One of the things you also point out is, and it's just a staggering number, You talk about 23 million IQ points are lost every year in children from exposure to lead. And the question is, of course, how do you put a price on that? I still don't think within the progressive sectors of and consciousness of the climate change and environmental activists that they have really grasped the imperative of looking at the things that we've been talking about as a social, political, a health crisis of paramount proportions. So how do you, obviously your book takes us a long way to educating, but would you, what kind of policies would you like to see evolve from this that take us beyond this terrifying crisis that seems to be deepening rather than abating?
In terms of the mainstream, I use for want of a better adjective, environmental groups, which are larger groups, Nationwide, Sierra Club, Major Conservancy, places like that, those kind of groups. Things are changing, actually. They have historically been focused on what a lot of people refer to as recreational environmental issues. I'm not sure recreational is the best label, but that's a label that's used. They've been focused on, you know, preserving the wild and on protecting wildlife and protecting the quality of our national parks and our wild areas and the animals who live in them, whose habitat it is, of protecting water. And there's always been some overlap, because in the protection of water and natural resources like that, that also is important to people of color, like is it everyone else. I mean, think about it, protecting water purity, what could be more important if you're thinking about, when you think about the crises across the nation in terms of lead. But even more importantly, there have been incursion of African Americans into these groups. When I was in Harvard School of Public Health back in 1992, I met Mary Nelson, who was with the Sierra Club, an African American lawyer, very active in it. And I realized how these groups were increasingly encompassing other African Americans who were concerned about both areas, both recreational environmentalism and also survival environmentalism. And Aaron Mayer, is African-American, in 2015 was elected the first national president of the Sierra Club. And also, so what I've seen is that these groups are now embracing the work of Robert Bullard. He's called the grandfather of the environmental movement. Mm. And so they're embracing his work. They've actually named awards after him. And they are changing. They're evolving, I like to think of it as, to embrace these life and death issues as well as their traditional issues around maintaining the wild. A very, very good thing. Of course, you know, one can argue that you'd like to see it happen more quickly, but the important thing is that it's happening at all. And I think that this is a very good thing as it continues. One of the things I exhort people to do in my two final chapters where I talk about what communities can actually do to try to change their environment, one of the important things I always point out is that instead of remaking the wheel, you should partner with some of these environmental groups that have shown an interest in the welfare of people of color and in the integrity of their homes. So I think that it's really changing, and I'm very happy to say that.
You know, one of the things that you've done just marvelously is that you really do provide an incisive analysis that just really frays and tears apart, which continuously needs to be done, issues such as that appear in the bell curve, those horrible, controversial theses of genetic, racial differences in IQ. You shred that.
Well, they're frankly illogical. It's not too hard to shred them.
Well, unfortunately, ideologically in our society, they still are very staid and prevalent. But what you've added so much to is, through the issue of environmental racism, a sense of the very issues of, again, of toxic waste and of pollution and insufficient sanitation services and heavy metals and the neurotoxins and all these things, the health-based issues that really provide the pathogens that do indeed influence how people are able to live their lives, from the intelligence of it to the diseases that break down our bodies, etc. And I must say that in my work, which is really poverty law, the numbers of people who come from the earliest age, the babies who immediately have asthma in their months old, the numbers of people who have rotted teeth in their 20s, all of these things, the environmental-based health influencers or metrics. I think one of the things that you've given us in this book, which is tremendously important, is that you're expanding out our understanding and what some of the discourse must be on public health and what we see as public health as well. And I wonder to how much you are conscious of and think that we need to broaden out our discussions to understand that environmental racism and the issues within that are fundamentally, essentially a public health life-affirming discussion that must be had and is not really been tackled enough.
Yes, it is a matter of public health. And I want to say something about that. In the early days of the discipline, public health practitioners, typically at schools of public health and, you know, medical institutions, confronted industries and confronted the government about unhealthful practices and about, you know, dangers that were being created by industry. But, you know, as time went on and public health has evolved, there's been a strong focus on individual responsibility. Individual responsibility is a good thing in and of itself, right? We all should undertake it. But, unfortunately, it's important to realize, I don't think everyone realizes that, in terms of environmental health, invoking personal responsibility is meaningless. There is nothing a lone individual can do about the fact that an industry is spewing chemicals and pesticides and polluting his air and water. It's not a matter of individual responsibility, and I think it's really important for us to understand the limits of that and to revert to the old model of confronting industry and confronting the government when that's what's called for. Here it is called for.
It also seems to me that you've taken it to another place. You dealt with this very holistically, which is very important. If we can control where people live, we can control really the development of their lives. And what I mean by that, the very zoning laws that have prevented people, even with higher incomes, who are people of color, from moving into particular neighborhoods, etc., also has a significant effect on their public health. I mean, one of the things I can most immediately think of, for example, in East Harlem, there are numerous bus depots where the buses idle for really 24-hour spans, not to mention that the depots are the repository underground of huge amounts of oil seepage and the like. People can afford to live in those specific areas, and their income precludes them from living in other areas in this city, a city which, as we now know, in terms of issues of, for example, the school system, that New York, much to many of our dismay, has one of the most significant and largest segregation of any area in the city. So,
right. But it's not.
I think all that is so critical that you bring to light, you deal with these issues in that kind of holistic way and understand that the housing limitations and redlining that it still exists in many ways, the zoning things, also trap us in a pattern of health destruction.
Yes, but the distribution of housing, of course, as you know, is not just financial. It's also due to racial bias. The redlining is based on race. So even people with sufficient incomes to live in certain areas of the city are not going to be able to live there because of housing discrimination. And discrimination, illegal discrimination against families with children. These are all factors that come into play as well as income. I have several friends who are very very savvy. They're very smart people and very savvy about real estate. And you know, two of them who are both white have you know gleefully told me about how they were able to purchase beautiful homes in New York City for a song. And I'm thinking, wow, I mean, they are really, they're definitely astute. They definitely know about real estate. They made these unbelievable deals to get their homes. But also, I wonder whether their race didn't play a role of it. Even if I had, which I do not, had that level of knowledge, would I have been, you know, able to do the same thing? One of them told me about how when he and his wife were looking at a condo, they're interviewed by the condo board, and he expressed to me surprise to find out that the condo board could legally discriminate on race. I mean, it's not, as a lawyer, you know, no one's going to write you can legally discriminate on race, but they were permitted to do that. They could discriminate on how many children that you had, things like that, which he had been unaware of. So there are a lot of factors, you know, besides economics, which is big in New York, that restrict where people can live.
Lastly, you wrote, we're basically operating in a sea, like a witch's brew, of industrial chemicals that are poisonous and are weakening our cognition. When lead was found to be devastatingly harmful, whites were able to go to the suburbs to housing that had never been exposed to lead. But black people were not allowed to move into the suburbs. I say all this to say it is incredibly important for people to grab up this book. It is so readable. It is so sharp and imperative in its conclusions, a terrible thing to waste. It's an outrage. It will transform the conversation, and it does inspire debate. But I want you to weigh in now. How do you want this conversation to be informed, and how do you want to inspire the debate with this enormously important book?
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to do. So I'm very pleased that that's what you read in the book. I wanted to change the conversation. I wanted several things. One, I wanted people to understand about IQ. IQ, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about it now, but in the book I spell out how IQ is not what we think of it as. It is a very flawed metric. It's filled with bias, but it does tell us something about intelligence. What it tells us is how well people have acquired knowledge. It doesn't tell you what your capacity for knowledge is, what your inherent ability to learn is, but it tells you how well you've mastered reading, how well you've mastered analytic discussion, how well you can manipulate numbers. Those things are important components of intelligence here in this country. And IQ does tell us that. That makes this a crude but very powerful metric for actually gauging how well people are doing. And when people are doing profoundly poorly and these same people are exposed to neurotoxins, well, there's a clear correlation going on here, a very strong one that's reinforced by lots of studies. And, of course, the other thing I want to do is to show how prevalent these exposures are and how a mixture of corporate greed and governmental inactivity has condemned people, especially people of color, to living in what we know to be highly toxic environments that are eroding both their bodies and their minds.
Harriet Washington, you have taught, and you have agitated, and you help us now to take up the task of organizing, because a terrible thing to waste, environmental racism and assault on the American mind, has given us a foundation through your discourse with us, but absolutely when you read the book, which I know we all will do at this point, to take us into an enhanced and imperative discussion about the public health, really the life and longevity of people in this country, and most definitively, people of color. Harriet, I want to thank you for taking the time. Your work is tremendously important, and it's it really is that kind of like douse of cold water that when people become somewhat complacent about what we think we know about in environmental-based issues, the intersectionality with the class and the race issues, which are so important, you just bring to light, and it continues to jolt us out of our complacency and our white privilege for sure.
Thank you so much, Mimi. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
We've been speaking with Harriet Washington, who deconstructs the fraudulent notion of intelligence as inherited trait. She identifies how institutional and environmental racism influence negatively cognitive abilities of those living in marginalized communities of color. A must read, a terrible thing to waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind, by Harriet Washington.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.